Europe was occupied. Russia invaded and Britain was bombed. But the nearest thing that World War II got to the continental United States were some Japanese submarine shells and a few incendiary bombs along the West Coast. For those who fought, this war, like all others, was hell. But most Americans never experienced it at first hand. On the home front, for millions, it actually proved a hell of a war. World War II finally pulled the country out of the Depression. In 1940, unemployment was still running at nearly 15%. By 1944, it was little over 1%. Much of this was due to conscription in the armed forces. For many young soldiers, the army was their first proper job. But war production also had a massive effect on the economy. One of the boom towns was Mobile, Alabama, suddenly a major shipyard. According to the writer John Dos Passos,
"The mouldering old Gulf seaport with its ancient dusty elegance of tall shuttered windows under mansard roofs and iron lace overgrown with vines looks trampled and battered like a city that's been taken by storm. Sidewalks are crowded, garbage cans are overflowing. The trailer army has filled all the open lots with its regular tanks. In cluttered backyards, people camp out in tents and chicken houses and shelters packed together out of packing cases."
This scene was replicated in cities across the South and the West Coast, from Charleston, South Carolina, to San Diego and up to Seattle. Some people said that the trailer parks and shanty towns that sprang up around the shipyards and aircraft factories were just like the mining camps of 1849. Except this time, the rush was for real wages, not fool's gold. So the war got America moving again, both economically and geographically. As a result of war work in the armed forces or in industry, almost 1 in 10 of the American population ended up settling permanently in a different state. One of the biggest migrations was of black Americans from the rural South into northern cities, resuming a flow that had dried up during the Depression. Employers still discriminated on racial grounds, but the demand for labour forced them to accept African Americans at least for the basic factory jobs. And that was a real gain for those used to the grinding poverty of tenant farming. Discrimination was rife in the armed forces as well. Blacks served in segregated units and in non-combatant roles such as construction and trucking. They had inferior facilities and were commanded by low-quality white officers, usually racist Southerners. But General George Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff, ruled out the idea of immediate integration. That, he said,
would be tantamount to solving a social problem which has perplexed the American people throughout the history of this nation. The settlement of vexing racial problems cannot be permitted to complicate the tremendous task of the War Department.
In Marshall's view, his job was to win the war, not engage in social engineering. But critics insisted that the two things were inseparable because racial integration and better training would boost black morale and efficiency. Their slogan was the double V, victory against fascism abroad and racism at home. According to a statement by black leaders,
"Though 13 million American Negroes have more often than not been denied democracy, they are American citizens and will, as in every war, give unqualified support to the protection of their country. At the same time, we will not abate one iota our struggle for full citizenship rights here in the United States. We will fight, but we demand the right to fight as equals."
Yet segregation had become almost an American way of life. The American Red Cross even segregated the plasma of white and black blood donors. And for one black soldier, Lloyd Brown, the ultimate moment was his reception at a lunchroom in Salina, Kansas.
"As we entered, the counterman hurried to the rear to get the owner, who hurried out front to tell us with urgent politeness, 'You boys know we don't serve colored here.' 'Of course we knew it. They didn't serve colored anywhere in town. There was no room at the inn for any black visitor. "You know, we don't serve colored here," the man repeated. We ignored him and just stood there inside the door, staring at what we had come to see. The German prisoners of war who were having lunch at the counter. This was really happening. It was no jive talk. The people of Salina would serve these enemy soldiers and turn away black American GIs.
Meanwhile, General Marshall's army was going to war. Not where he'd wanted, in France, but in North Africa, because the British feared that an early cross-channel attack would be suicidal. At this stage, in 1942, Britain was still the senior partner in the alliance. Its military planners were better organised, and the British Empire provided more of the combat troops in Europe. The initial American landings in Morocco and Algeria in November 1942 were successful, but once ashore, the US Army learned a rude lesson at Kasserine Pass, when whole battalions panicked and fled after a surprise German attack. Harry Butcher, press aide to the US commander, General Dwight Eisenhower, wrote in his diary,
"The outstanding fact to me is that the proud and cocky Americans today stand humiliated by one of the greatest defeats in our history. All those concerned have learned now that this is not a child's game. Despite all the adversity, the troops are in good heart and have developed a deep anger. This replaces a certain softness that was characteristic of all units before the attack."
It took the Americans and the British much longer than they'd hoped to drive the Germans and Italians out of North Africa. This made it impossible to build up men and supplies in Britain to mount an invasion of France in 1943. So the Allies invaded Italy, hoping to knock it quickly out of the war. But again, the Germans fought tenaciously, and the Italian campaign became bogged down in mud and ice. Italy was Churchill's hobby horse, and by late 1943, Roosevelt and his advisers were losing patience. Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, told FDR,
"The British theory is that Germany can be beaten by a series of attritions in northern Italy, in the eastern Mediterranean, and other satellite countries. I believe, therefore, that the time has come for you to decide that your government must assume the responsibility of leadership in this great final movement of the European war."
In 1944, the United States did become the senior partner in the Anglo-American alliance, in manpower, supplies, and command. The Allied landings in Normandy in June 1944 were headed by Eisenhower, and the broad front strategy he adopted for the final advance overruled the British preference for a narrow thrust into northern Germany. Just before Christmas, Churchill wearily told those who wanted him to take a tougher line with the Americans,
"You must remember that our armies are only about one half the size of the American and will soon be little more than one third. It's not so easy as it used to be for me to get things done."
American dominance at the front reflected what Roosevelt called the massive arsenal of democracy back home. By 1944, the United States was producing 40% of the world's armaments, a tribute to both the country's resources and its greater productivity. A legendary example was Henry Kaiser, a construction tycoon who tried his hand at ships with spectacular success, winning the nickname Sir Launcelot. Instead of building the vessel from the keel upwards, one rib at a time, using a variety of specialist workmen, Kaiser adopted production line methods with prefabricated parts and semi-skilled labour. The most striking testimony to America's industrial might was the atomic bomb. In the early years of the war, the British were ahead in the theoretical work. But building a bomb in cramped, war-ravaged Britain was near impossible. So Churchill shared the research with Roosevelt, kick-starting a massive project innocuously codenamed the Manhattan Engineer District. Its mastermind was an army engineer called General Leslie Groves. Uncertain about the best and fastest way to build an atomic bomb, the Americans took what was called the Napoleonic approach of trying everything simultaneously. Groves commandeered vast tracts of wilderness in the Pacific Northwest to produce plutonium, and in the mountains of Tennessee for uranium enrichment. Weapons design and testing took place at Los Alamos, a remote desert plateau in New Mexico. The total cost was nearly $2 billion. No other nation could have found the land and the resources. Years later, when Niels Bohr, the Danish physicist, saw Los Alamos, he exclaimed,
"I told you it couldn't be done without turning the whole country into a factory. You have done just that."
The bomb had been intended for possible use on Germany, but the Nazi regime surrendered in May 1945.
Throughout the world, throngs of people hailed the end of the war in Europe. It is 5 years and more since Hitler marched into Poland. Years full of suffering and death and sacrifice.
At this point, America itself had also entered a new era.
President Truman announced the official surrender.
"This is a solemn but glorious hour. I wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to see this day."
On April the 12th, President Roosevelt had collapsed and died from a cerebral hemorrhage. Elected for a fourth term the previous November, FDR had served for more than 12 years in the White House, spanning some of the most anguished years in the country's history, the Depression and the war. So it was a new and totally inexperienced leader, Harry Truman, who had to decide whether to use the atomic bomb on Japan. The US Army and Navy had gradually hopped across the Pacific, island to island, but the losses were high and an invasion of Japan itself would face savage resistance. In any case, the Japanese had never been forgiven for Pearl Harbor, and the US Army Air Force was already indiscriminately firebombing its wooden cities. So Truman gave the order, and America's two operational atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
"Anyone not having dark glasses would have received a visual shock several miles away. One of the crew members said, 'My God,' when he saw what had happened. What had been Hiroshima was a white mountain of smoke. About 1,000 feet off the ground, it looked like boiling dust. This one bomb is the equivalent of a 2,000 B-29 raid. This is Webley Edwards."
A few days later, Japan capitulated.
"Mr. Truman told reporters at the White House that the note from the Japanese specifies the unconditional surrender of Japan. There is no qualification," unquote.
The national mood was exultant. In the new jargon of the time, the United States was not just a great power, like the now creaky British Empire, but a superpower. So August 1945 was a heady moment. But like all such moments, it wouldn't last. Because the war also brought forth another superpower with totally alien values. The new nuclear age would turn into a worldwide struggle between them.